Okay, we're starting the College Admissions and Financial Aid Secrets Workshop at the Manhasset Library. If you're listening to this on the College Planning Edge podcast, just imagine a huge stadium full of 110,000 people, like the big house at University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. But a little smaller. So, all right. So, welcome. So, what we did already before I started recording this was write down a few of the questions that the moms, mostly, right, all moms had in mind that we're going to be covering today. You guys, of course, feel free to. You can reserve the right to ask more questions as we go along. So, this presentation is about getting into college and paying for college. So, I didn't see any questions about that. Second part yet, the financial aid or scholarship part, but you can certainly, again, ask those questions if you have them. So I guess so most of these are about what does it take to get in to a top school. That's how I would characterize these questions. There's questions about what classes should you take as early as ninth grade, summer programs, extracurriculars in general, the SAT and the ACT, as my handwriting started to drift downward on that one. A question about the PSAT, should you take that more than once? These are all great questions. So I think the way that that I think about this whole process of getting into a top college is first of all, I think it kind of omits a bigger question, a bigger issue, which is, and I don't blame you, I'm not casting aspersions on parents or guidance counselors or kids or whatever, but if you mess around on the internet and you're searching, you know, for information on college stuff, you'll come across some people who talk, and I run ads on the internet too, so I'm very well aware of this, on Facebook and wherever. There are a few people who concentrate on this is how you get scholarships and whatever. And there's a lot of people who have a message along the lines of, you know, 93% of our clients get into one of their top three colleges, or, you know, how to do your passion project and all these types of things. So I think those are kind of funny, personally, because number one, you know, if I could control every kid's college list, then I could, you know, okay, you're going to apply to Harvard, Yale, and Nassau Community College, and boom, I can guarantee one out of three. that you'll get into because everyone gets into Nassau Community College. But the second part that I think eclipses the bigger picture is that, okay, once you're into college, well, you know, then what? So the thing that's different about, you know, somewhat this presentation, but definitely about me and our firm is that, you know, I think college is great and we have clients every year who get in, I mean, every year without fail, to Ivy Leagues and near Ivies and you know, elite schools. We also have kids who go to a community college, some take gap years, and then many are somewhere in between, you know, those two, I guess, ends of the spectrum. I have four kids in my own family. I've got two boys who went the state university, you know, SUNY route and local route. And I've got two girls who each got into Ivy League schools, but one chose to go and one chose not to go. So I see it, you know, both professionally and personally, that it's not really about where you go, it's what you put into it, and then therefore what you get out of it. What you get out of it really depends on your efforts, as you know, you as a student. And there's no correlation between where you go and how successful you will be. There's literally no correlation. No matter how many times people try to make a case for, oh, well, if you get into an Ivy League school, everything is set for the rest of your life, it's not. And I'm sure you know people the same way I know people who are, you know, brilliant academically and maybe got into one of those types of colleges, but they're non-functional or very low functioning. So as well as people who, hello, you, I have a gift. You can choose a gift here. I have a choice of two books. Either one, as well as people who are extremely successful, you know, multimillionaires or even more, at least financially. All right, enjoy. Yes. Yeah, yes. One. Yeah, watch it. Yeah. Did you guys plan this? It's like a heist. Yeah. Okay. You know, people barely even went to college or didn't go at all or went to just a regular school. You know, there's so many of them who are, you know, incredibly successful. So of course, we all want our kids to be successful, and we think that a lot of it has to do with, you know, putting them in an environment where they're going to be positioned to succeed. And sometimes that's in elite school, and sometimes it's not. And many times, you know, the kids who don't get in to their top colleges still end up, you know, maybe they have a little chip on their shoulder and they work a little bit harder instead of coasting, and then they do really well, you know, maybe because they were rejected. And there's all sorts of examples of celebrities like Warren Buffett who didn't get into his top business school, and, you know, all these other people that I won't bore you with. I just want to make the point that, yes, all the stuff about getting into college, that's what you're here for, and maybe some of you about, you know, paying for college. But I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about it. There's really a bigger picture here, which I think gets eclipsed by not just parents, but definitely guidance counselors, and certainly all of the relentless marketing from all these colleges that some of you with younger kids probably haven't gotten yet, but some of you with kids who've already registered for the PSAT or the SAT. Once you do that, that's sort of a milestone. Then you get slammed with all the emails and sometimes texts and sometimes phone calls and sometimes, well, almost all the time, hard snail mail brochures, which I personally think are really funny because, you know, no matter where the school is located, you've got kids in shorts, you know, frolicking outside on the quad, every race and ethnicity, nobody has any acne, you know, which implies that if you go to that college, you'll never get a zit. Anyway, there's a lot of marketing involved here, and the reason that so many parents and kids feel so much pressure as they progress through this process, as you know, you have a senior, so you're in the thick of it, has a lot to do with the marketing that the colleges do themselves to create this pressure. Like, there's no reason that you should be pressured to apply to a college early decision, except that it helps the colleges fill their seats. But kids get in this, you know, it's like a frenzy. And it just ratchets up. The closer you get, you know, midway through junior year till senior year, it's almost unbearable. So, okay. So what does it take to get into a top school? So there's really, broadly speaking, a couple different categories of things or factors. And I would say it's roughly 60% academic stuff. And that means your grades, although not as much as it used to because of grade inflation. At most high schools, I think 47% of kids across the country have A averages. There are no more kids with Cs. Like, when we were growing up, I mean, I might be a little older than some of you guys, but when we were growing up, kids had C averages. Now the lowest, you know, the lowest GPA, I think, is like an 84, right? So why is that? The question is from the anonymous mom, so you don't get in trouble. The question is because parents complain so much about their kids not getting, you know, great grades or satisfactory grades, that high schools decided to, you know, kowtow to their customers. And that's why some schools have 15 valedictorians, you know, so no one gets left out. And that's why to get into honor society, you need to break into the top 70% of your class to get that participation trophy, you know? So it's meaningless. But admissions officers understand this, which is why So the three academic factors are GPA, rigor, meaning how hard your course load is, which is one of the questions that I put on the board here, and your SAT or your ACT. So the reason that, and by the way, I should have said this in the beginning, some of the stuff that's going to come out of my mouth is definitely different than what you're going to hear from, you know, other parents or your guidance counselor, for sure, whether you go to a public high school or a private one. And some of it may contradict, you know, what you think you know or you've been told. And I'm not saying that I'm right 1,000%, but I'm sharing with you, my own experiences being a college advisor for more than 20 years. So the rigor is the second most important academic factor, and test scores, even though 75%+ of colleges are test optional, in a vacuum, admissions officers would rather have tests, SAT and ACT scores to look at, because they are, it turns out, actually better predictors of how well a student is going to do in college. And lately, several top schools and other near top schools, I think it's Yale was one of the most recent ones, Brown might have been the other Ivy, announced that they are no longer test optional, they're requiring scores. University of Texas Austin, I think, announced that the other day, that they are now requiring test scores. It's 20-25% of the colleges in the country require the SAT and the ACT because of this grade inflation. The policy behind test optional was to, I guess, address the reality that kids who work with, high-priced tutors and college advisors, have more resources to be able to score, better on these exams. But so therefore, making schools not require these exams would diversify. Would help increase diversity at these campuses. So, in fact, what Yale and Brown and every school that's rescinded their test optional positions has said, in fact, it was the opposite has happened. They saw fewer underrepresented minorities, they admitted fewer underrepresented minorities because they did not submit their test scores because they thought they'd be too low. Hey guys, you have a choice of a gift here.
Great, thank you.
Either one. Oh, you're with them. Okay, fine. Okay. I rescind the gift. Offer rescinded. But if you have trouble sleeping, borrow her book. So rigor was the second academic factor, and rigor means AP classes. My kids grew up and went through the North Shore District, which has an IB program. That APs and IBs are sort of interchangeable. The more you take, the more impressive it is to an admissions officer. And if you're applying to a top, like an Ivy or a near Ivy type of school, or even schools that are, they think they're Ivies but they're not, like Notre Dame or Boston College or Georgetown or whatever, you're competing with kids who have taken, maybe 12, 14 plus AP classes through the duration of their high school careers. I have clients at, most of our clients are, I'd say 60% are sort of in the tri-state area, then the rest are from other states or other countries. And I have some clients who've taken 17 or 18 AP classes, which most high schools don't allow, but I think Half Hollows East allows you to do that. The way it looks for admissions officers is that if you have the ability, like if you go to a Manhasset high school where you can probably take 13 or 14 or so, you have the ability to take a rigorous course load, and you don't avail yourself of that opportunity, that actually looks worse than another kid who went to a different high school that didn't have as many options to take the APs. Question? Yeah.
What if your child would get a better grade if he didn't take an AP class? Like if he would get like an A minus or B plus in the AP class as opposed to an A plus in the honors class?
All right, so I'm gonna rephrase the question, just correct me if I'm wrong. So is it better to take an AP and get a lower grade versus a non-AP and get a slightly higher grade?
Yes.
I would say take the AP and get the higher grade, because I'm a professional. You can trust me on that. Yeah, yeah. you know, that's why I get paid a lot of money to give advice. Yeah. Now the thing is that you know, again, I would always go for the harder class, and because of grade inflation, because, you know, et cetera, et cetera, it's not a foregone conclusion that the grade is going to be lower across the board. It might be, but it's much easier to start at the high level and then drop down if you need to, versus doing it the other way around, which is impossible. So one of the bits of advice that I talk about in my anti guidance counselor rant, which is really not, but the book How to Survive Your Guidance Counselor's Lack of Advice. One of the problems I think that a lot of guidance counselors create is when they have a very high achieving kid, and most kids are not, right? So they're I'd say 5%, 10% are really striving for, you know, Ivy and those types of schools, and they should be, but that's not right for everyone. But I think what I observe with guidance counselors is a lot of them give sort of the same advice to everyone, no matter how high achieving they are or not, which is, you don't have to take it, don't worry about it, you know, you don't need to stress out. And I think overall they're pretty, the counselors are well-intentioned, because, you know, they see a lot of mental health issues and, you know, kids struggling with physical health, you know, because they're taking too hard a course load. But if you're gunning for, and the answer really depends on what your goals are, or what the child's goals are for college. So if you're gunning for, you know, a super high elite school, you're competing with all sorts of other kids who have done exactly what I'm talking about. And you're not competing, this is something else that's different that most people don't really agree with in terms of parents, but in terms of college advisors and in terms of admissions officers, you're not competing with kids at Manhattan High School or, you know, or wherever you go. You're competing with kids all over the country. There's no quota. I know this sounds funny, but there's no quota in any given high school. So when, like, Jericho High School kids tell me, oh, we had a bad year this year, we had only 3 kids get into Michigan, or, you know, only 5 go to Duke, you know, or something crazy like that, they're sort of implying that, well, last year was a, you know, a better year, and so they had to somehow readjust it. But that's not the way it works. You're competing with kids all over the country, and it's 60% academic, which I'm kind of working my way through here, and then 40% other stuff, which I'll get to. So rigor is really important. So I'd always, you know, if your child is gunning for a top school, this is how I describe it when I have these the conversations that I usually have. Like the kid will come in to my office and say something like, you know, I'm thinking about dropping whatever, you know, from AP to, you know, AP Spanish to regular. And I'll say, yeah, that's fine, but let's just go over the schools that you're going to be applying to again. And then if it's like Harvard, Yale, Princeton, you know, Penn, Cornell, et cetera, I'm like, yeah, well, you're competing with kids who are not doing that. So you're going to be applying with one hand tied behind your back if you don't take the most challenging courses that you can. I'm not saying that's right for you, you know, because I sure wouldn't have done that when I was in high school. But that's, you have to understand the bigger context, because every choice that you have from ninth grade forward, sometimes even earlier, not third grade, okay? But every you know, inflection point, every decision you have to make will have repercussions 2 or 3 years later when you're applying to college. Because what you do when you're applying to college is you're summing up your whole, you know, body of work from ninth grade forward. And that includes all the academic stuff, and then it also includes all the other non-academic stuff. So any questions about GPA, rigor, or test scores? Yeah.
So my daughter is taking 5 AP classes, and for the second quarter she wanted to drop the elective that she had signed up for because of the workload.
Right.
How bad is that?
So the question is, 5 AP classes and plus an elective that she wants to drop?
The elective, she dropped it.
Okay.
She got her new program. She ended up dropping the elective.
Got it. But she didn't drop any of the AP classes. Yeah, that's not going to affect, if she's gunning for those top colleges, dropping an elective won't really matter compared to dropping an AP or dropping down from an AP.
And then I have another question.
Yeah, follow-up question.
End of school year grades. How does that come into play? The schools.
End of senior year grades.
Yeah.
Okay, so how do end of senior year grades come into play? For the most part, they're not relevant unless someone tanks, and then the school has to report those F's and D's to the college, and they might get their offer rescinded. But
so if they get better, it's not.
But
Doesn't matter.
If they're B's instead of A's, that's okay. Mm-hmm. But in general, mid-year grades, which you're not asking me about, sometimes kids get senioritis a little bit early in the year. And if they get deferred or waitlisted, that's a problem because those mid-year grades count. Yeah, they're still potentially looking at them. And we've seen that a lot, too. Or kids took on too much their senior year and their grades, you know, went south.
Thank you.
Question?
So the AP class is now used as audition type? Or when I was in school, APs were used to use as college credit. And if you accumulated enough of them, you could get out of a semester or an entire year of college. I went to college for 3.5 years because of what I accumulated in high school. I didn't have to go to my last semester of college. So has the focus of the APs shifted at all? Or, I mean, they're still used that way, right? They're still used as college credit, right?
So AP the question was about AP classes. Do they how do they count, you know, toward college credit, and how are they used in general? So fewer and fewer colleges now will give you credit for taking an AP because they need the money. But the big state universities tend to be the ones that will give you college credit if you A, took an AP class, and then B, did well enough on the AP exam. Same thing for the IB diploma. So I mentioned before, I have 4 kids. I have 2 boys and 2 girls, totally different, you know, academic trajectories. My boys were pioneers of the homework optional movement in high school. And my girls were, you know, they were much better walking advertisements for our business. So and they all have redeeming qualities. And I actually think, you know, I don't know who's going to be the most successful. I think there's a good argument for any of the 4. But my girls, my older girl did the IB diploma at North Shore High School, and she did well enough on the exams, and she was able to enter the University of Michigan, where she ended up choosing to go as a sophomore. And of course, she's still going to take 4 years there because she's, you know, president of sorority. She's, you know, she loves all the football games, and, you know, money's no object to her. It doesn't matter that I have 4 kids in college, 3 in college. Whereas her sister, who's a freshman at Cornell, they did not take nearly as many. They took some, but they didn't take nearly as many of the IB, you know, same test that she did well on. So it varies.
It's variable, what you're saying, depending on which college you go to, how much of that they accept as.
Yeah. So for the most part, the colleges that tend to accept the AP classes and IB classes, if you do well, if you get a 4 or 5, sometimes a 3, but usually 4 or 5, are the big state universities in and out of the state of New York. But what it does show is rigor. It shows that you challenge yourself. So that's the main reason that helps you get into a school compared to people who didn't take as much of a rigorous course load. That's the main thing. All right.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Those schools that do take the AP credits, I should say, how does that impact for if you're getting financial assistance or scholarship? Like, I know that there's a certain number of credits that some of those scholarships or financial assistance, like, you need to have at least 12 to 15 credits per semester. If you're already going in with a good amount of credits, and then you're only able to select credits that are applying to your major, minor, et cetera, like, how does that affect when you get to, like, junior and senior year? How does that affect your ability to continue with on getting that scholarship?
Yeah, good. All right, great question about how does, I guess, banking credits from AP classes affect your college aid and merit aid? For the most part, it's not an issue because colleges have sort of, you know, cut back on how many college credits they will allocate from your APs. But you do have, in order to get aid, you do have to be a full-time student. If that's not the case, then they will cut it back. But it's very rare, so I wouldn't worry about it. Yeah, at all. Yes.
I have some questions.
Yes.
To take the exam.
Well, I'm talking about when I mentioned taking 17 or 18 AP classes. That's first of all, that's extremely unusual. But there is a district on Long Island that lets you do that. It's not Manhasset. And second of all, I'm referring to the actual class, not the exams. But you should take the exams also.
Just the classes.
Just the classes.
The classes
in the high school. But for the most part, if you take the class in the high school, you're going to sit for the exam also.
Okay.
The exam's an hour. It's not like taking a full-blown SAT or an ACT. Yeah, it's not bad.
Yes.
Okay. Suggestion.
Just at ninth grade, you can take how many and
10. Oh, sure. So the question is how to plan out your AP classes?
Yes.
Well, for the most part, you're bound by what the high school lets you do. So very few high schools let you take classes in AP in ninth grade, but some do. Very few in 10th grade, except for human geography or something, and then they start ratcheting it up in 11th and 12th grades, where you can take 5 or 6. So you're sort of bound by what your high school permits. But again, I'm not saying that everyone should take 58 AP classes. What I'm saying is that it depends on your goals, because if you're not trying to throw your hat in the ring to get into an Ivy League or a near Ivy League school necessarily, in which case you'd be competing with all these try hard, high achieving kids, then you don't have to knock yourself out that way. But that's the reality is that in a blind science, a lot of kids and parents, when they find out too late that they should have pushed themselves to take the extra AP, and that's why they didn't get into Stanford or Duke or any of the Ivies, et cetera. So it's good that you guys have younger kids, if that's the goal, right, to get into these types of schools. Okay, any other questions on the 60% of what it takes to get into college? Okay, so the 40% is a combination of some stuff that is in your control and some things that are out of your control. And I'm not really apologizing, I'm sort of warning you in advance that this is not necessarily what I would call politically correct information. But they've invited me back to speak, for years, so I guess it's not that offensive. But we'll see. All right. So when I say stuff that you can control, extracurriculars is one of the main areas. So is your application, right? Your essays. Some schools still interview, although most of them don't anymore. And when I talk about extracurriculars and summer programs and everything you do that's basically not sitting in class, there's two categories of those types of extracurriculars. There's typical and there's atypical. So for the most part, I have nothing against doing the same stuff that everyone else does, but that's not going to separate you. So if you're on a team, it's great. If you're in, I mentioned this before, if you're in National Honor Society, along with the top 70% of your class, that is fine, and you're doing good stuff. If you do a charity walk or a walk last weekend that raises money to do research for breast cancer, autism, and a cause to be named later, that's all fine. But that's not going to get you in to a college. Because you're not going to stand out. So when you're applying to college, what you have to understand is, and this is, I don't mean this to be offensive, but the reality is, if you are a white kid from Manhasset applying to an Ivy League school or whatever, and by the way, I'm not prejudiced. I have many white friends. I really like white people. That's funny. How's that not funny? That's hilarious.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. That's my best. That's honestly is my best joke. Okay. moving along. You gotta help me out. So the issue is that there might be 50,000 other kids who basically look the same on paper. So how do you distinguish yourself? How do you answer what I call the invisible question? It's not actually written on the common application. That's why I call it invisible. And that question is, why should we take you compared to these other 50,000, you know, white kids from Manhasset or Manhasset-like neighborhoods throughout the country? And that could easily say Asian American. I could say, you know, it's the same thing. How do you stand out? How do you, you know, from the pack? And to me, that is a marketing concept. It's not a meritocracy. It's how you market yourself. It's how you stand out. It's how you answer that question, why you, compared to these other 50,000 kids. And if you fail to answer that, and the good news is, because most of you guys have, you know, younger kids, the earlier you start thinking about that and assembling, you know, that and beefing up that body of work from ninth grade forward, the more able you will be to answer that question. And the other concept that I want to introduce to you, that you wouldn't have heard anywhere else because I made this up, is that when you're listing out everything you've done on your common application from ninth grade forward, there should be a thread of continuity that kind of ties everything together. It doesn't have to fit totally neatly like a puzzle piece, a bunch of puzzle pieces, but you're telling a story that in effect communicates the value that you are bringing potentially to that campus. Because colleges are businesses, that's probably not shocking, even though they're nonprofit, which is a sick, cruel joke. You know, because someone has to pay for the lazy rivers and Corian countertop, you know, dorm kitchens. But whether our kids realize this or not, and this is something I screamed at my own kids, you know, until I was blue in the face, I was like, you know, you guys, even if you don't get it, you're in business for yourself. And that's the business of learning how to promote yourself, to advocate for yourself, be persuasive, and explain why you should be chosen, you know, compared to everyone else that you're competing with. And just to come full circle, when I was saying before, like, I, you know, college is 4 years, I care more about the 40 plus years, that ability to promote yourself and persuade, you know, in your own way, that's congruent with your own personality, that's a life skill. That's not only a get into college skill. So that's a big part of what, you know, the type of advice we try to help kids with. And I'll say frankly, without sounding like a jerk, because no one would care, this is why I'm not bragging, I promise you, but the reason I've written a whole bunch of books and I get in the news kind of regularly, it was on twice this week, and I do all these presentations and webinars and stuff, is really for the same reason. I'm eating my own cooking. I'm trying to explain to you that this is why you should pay attention to me. I'm not saying everyone should work, you know, with us, but I'm promoting myself, right? Promoting our business. So it's not abstract with me. I mean, I'm really a marketing guy trapped in a college advisor's body, which is creepy. Yeah, I don't even like hearing that come out of my mouth, but that's the reality. So there's typical and there's atypical activities. So it's I'll draw a difference. So it's great to be on a team, but it's atypical to be, you know, a captain or Allstate or, you know, whatever. It's great to be a musician, atypical to go to NISMA or, you know, get those types of awards. It's typical to be in Scouts, girls or Boy Scouts, but atypical to be get the Gold Award or the Eagle, because 4% of kids get Eagle. So those types of things, the deeper you go, the more you're communicating the value that you'll bring to the campus, which is that you are involved and you have impact. So you don't have to rush off and do a summer program at Harvard or a service trip to Hawaii, that's a real example, or to the Dominican Republic. You know, all those things reek of privilege, which is, you know, at least publicly for colleges these days, not a good thing. You know, they're very down on privilege these days, even though 80%. So this one killed me. So during the whole, when was this? It was right before October 7th. But there was a lot of discussion about DEI and all these DEI officers. You know, some colleges have like 200 diversity, equity, and inclusion officers. And I don't know where you guys stand politically. I'm not going to go there, but 200 is ridiculous. I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. Okay. Plus, at all these state universities, they're pretty diverse as it is. So I'm not really sure what they're doing. Anyway, so my youngest one, the ones at Cornell, she sent me something that they had sent out saying they were studying this issue, and they determined that 80% of their students came from what they call feeder high schools, which are basically private high schools like Choate and Fieldston and Dalton and Andover and Exeter and whatever, 80%. I'm like, okay, so how are you like all for diversity and all that? You know, it's hilarious to me. But so that's a big factor of getting into college also is like, what high school did you come from? And then you can't really control that one. I mean, to some extent, you really can't control that. But if you think about atypical versus typical, that will help you understand what admissions officers are looking for. So again, nothing wrong with doing the same stuff everyone else does, but that can't be everything in your resume. And you don't have to confine yourself to what's offered in school in terms of clubs. In fact, I would argue that going outside of the universe of what's offered in school is probably better. You'll probably be able to have more impact more easily. So you don't have to found a club. You don't have to have a form your own 501c3 charity, because all that does is tell admissions officers that you had like a dad who did that for you or a mom who did that for you, right? They see right through all this stuff. So the thing about summer programs at colleges, those are fine, but they don't help you, like Wake Forest has a summer program, Georgetown has one, all these schools have them, but that doesn't help you get into those schools, those particular respective schools, number one. And number two, they're basically pay to play. They're not prestigious. Some of them are, but most of the ones that kids do are not. They're like summer camp. So they're good in that they show that you're serious about exploring campus life and maybe taking a class, but they're not standout, terrific indicators that you qualify for some really hard thing. Does that make sense? Did I answer a couple of the questions that we had before? Yes? Okay. So the good extracurriculars in general, the ones that help you get into college, are the ones that are not the same stuff that the rest of the crowd is doing. That's the one bottom line here. All right. I did not answer the question about should you take the PSAT more than once. So the PSAT at many, but not most high schools, you can sit for it in 10th grade. That's a true practice one. And it helps you just get used to sitting in a chair for extended periods of time. The new SAT, by the way, the digital one, is shorter than the old one. So I believe the PSAT is going to be shorter now also. That would make sense. But the 11th grade PSAT is the one that counts for National Merit Scholar consideration. And there's no magic number that you need to hit on the PSAT in 11th grade to become National Scholar, because it varies from state to state. So the more academic states like New York and Massachusetts or whatever, you have to hit a higher score than if you went to Arkansas, high school in Arkansas or something. But it's generally in the mid-1400s from New York to hit the PSAT score in 11th grade, which is hard, but it's an easier test than the SAT, and it's relatively speaking, it's doable. So I would, if you have a kid who's a good test taker, I would start them earlier. In that case, if you think there's a reasonable shot of them being able to hit the national, come close to national merit in 11th grade. But for the most part, we do tutoring, and what my head tutor always says is that you're not going to have an advantage on the SAT or the ACT until you've had Algebra 2, which for most kids is after 10th grade, but not everyone. So the summer between, I don't know if it's most kids, but the summer between 10th and 11th grade seems to be the best time to start the test prep. There are some families who start like in 6th grade and 7th grade and earlier. They don't get higher scores. They get burnt out. Our feeling is study hard, get the high, get the top of the range as soon as you can, which most kids need 2 or 3 times easily to do that, and then you're done. So ideally, prep over the summer, take one in the fall, take 2 in spring, and then be done. But a lot of kids will take it. But there's a point of diminishing return where you don't really improve after numbers 4 and 5 or whatever. But they are important. Even the schools that are test optional, most of them will look at the test scores to award merit aid. And even states like California, which are quote-unquote test blind, meaning they don't look at the test at all, to decide whether or not you're getting into a UC or a Cal State school, they still look at the test scores to place you in classes and to award merit aid, which they don't. That's in the fine print. They don't tell you that. So the scores still matter. The testing still matters a lot. All right. Was there anything else I should have amplified in my remarks? Yes. Yeah, that's a great test question. So the question's about super scoring. Do most colleges accept that? So my first answer is, even if a school doesn't accept that, like MIT wants to see every test you've ever taken, what they're looking for is the anomaly. They're looking for something that doesn't fit in with the common understanding that kids in, you know, affluent areas take these tests multiple times and show improvement or show different results. Because that's kind of what you do in college. You know, you get a bunch of information, you study it, then you perform on a test, and sometimes you do better, sometimes you don't. Right? But it's about your preparation. So they understand that. What they're looking for is, you know, a kid who gets a 1200, a 1250, a 1260, and then a 1570. That's going to be weird for the admissions officers. It's also going to be weird for the College Board or the ACT if you do that on the equivalent. So we've actually had kids spike up on their test scores, and they got flagged by the ACT, and another kid got flagged by the College Board just to make sure they weren't cheating, which was, you know, kind of a backhanded compliment to the kid and to our tutor, but it was nerve-wracking for a while. So for the most part, every college, except a few exceptions like MIT, Georgetown might be another one, will allow you to only submit your top components. And in terms of the strategy, yeah, I think in general, you want to try to get the high score in all parts, whether it's the SAT or the ACT initially, at least a couple of times. And then you'll see where the dust settled and what the highest and best use of your time is to focus on how you're going to get your score where you need it to be. So I would start off without any real strategy that way, about focusing your efforts on one of the components, and then usually after taking it twice, that's when you start trying to hone in on, you know, maybe it's the science section on the ACT, where you just need to get two more points in order to cross that hurdle of whatever score you're trying to get. But it's easy to sort of outthink yourself too in these situations, for sure. Yeah. Any other questions on this academic stuff, college stuff? Did I leave anything out that was asked before? Yes.
Why do some people take ACT? I've heard of SAT.
Yeah. Why do some people take the ACT?
What is the ACT?
Well, okay. So, when most of us were growing up, if you grew up on the East Coast or the West Coast, it was only the SAT, yeah. And the Midwest took the ACT. It's just a different standardized test that has a different format. Most people do about the same on each, but there are key differences. Colleges are agnostic. They'll take either. So really what it comes down to is what feels better for each test taker. So what we do is we give a diagnostic, which is 50% SAT, 50% ACT, grade it, see which one they did better on. Usually if they're similar, then it's more about, did you run out of time on the ACT, because there are more questions per hour on the ACT than the SAT, which is a slower paced test. There's other differences too, especially with the new digital SAT. So it really comes down, you can take either, and it just comes down to which one is, you know, the best fit. But by the time your kids are, you know, coming up, who knows? I mean, who knows, you know, maybe they'll merge at some point, you know, because, well, that's, you know, what happened was the SAT was dominant, then the ACT took on more market share, then about 7 or 8 years ago, more people took the ACT, so the SAT changed formats to become more ACT-like, and then there's been sort of like a jockeying, and now it's a digital digital exam, mostly because of all the schools that were test optional and they're not making as much money on testing as they used to. But they do make money on selling your name, your data. So when you register for the SAT through the College Board, on average, supposedly, they sell your information, your kids' information, 18 times from 10th grade till 12th grade, which is why you get all those brochures and all that stuff. Mystery solved. Oh, I just heard about a scam too. This is great. So I was on Fox 5 two nights ago. I hadn't heard about the scam, but the reporter asked me if I had. So I'm like, yeah, of course, yeah. But it was from last month, and I guess one of the producers at Fox 5 fell for this. So there was somebody who was saying, we're going to send you free SAT study materials. And the parent would be like, okay, great. But we need your credit card just to cover, whatever, shipping or something. And it was like $130. And some people paid $600 for the free SAT materials. So I'm like, huh, that's kind of like failing an SAT if you fall for that. but anyway, that was a new one that I hadn't heard. So usually the scams I hear in college, besides all the crazy ones, like Lori Loughlin and all that. Did you guys see the Curb Your Enthusiasm with Lori Loughlin? Oh, is that funny? So you know the scam about Lori Loughlin, paying and all that. Okay, so I just watched this last night. It was so funny. So she's trying to get into the country club that Larry belongs to. So he vouches for her, and she gets in, and then she lies about her score. She has like a fake handicap thing so she can drive her cart everywhere even when people can't. And she has a handicap sticker on her car when she drives off. It was so funny. So I give her credit for that, I guess. But the scams that usually come out are usually like people stealing your identity and then filing a financial aid application and borrowing and never paying it back in your name. Those are the types of scams that usually go around. That was one of the big reasons why all the FAFSA, the main federal financial aid form, was overhauled, just to prevent that and have all these like double secret ways that you can sign in and all that. So the fake SAT study materials was a pretty creative one. All right, do you guys have any questions on the money aspect of it, on the financial aid or scholarships aspect? How to pay for college? Yes. Rob a bank. No, yeah. Yeah, right. Get divorced, sell your house, rob a bank. So, right. All right. So the thing about financial aid is that there's different types, right? So, most of our clients don't qualify for. We do a lot of financial aid paperwork. So my wife, who was napping on the couch, otherwise I would have brought her here. Because she played golf today, it was warm. She files like 400 families worth of financial aid applications, every year. She's like a farm animal. She's got a much better work ethic than I do. And but most of the people who live in areas like Manhasset and Roslyn and Jericho, and where we have a lot of our clients, do not qualify for need-based aid, which is based on income, meaning adjusted gross income. Although, to be fair, we have quite a few self-employed people who have good accountants, or we refer good accountants to them. But anyway, income is the most important thing. And then, depending on what schools you're applying to, your house might count against you or it might not count against you. But that's one aspect of financial aid that's called need-based aid. Most of the money that's out there has nothing to do with that. Most of the money, so if you don't qualify for need-based aid, that's not terrible at all. Most of the money that's out there is based on what they call merit aid, which is sort of a catch-all category that means anything that's not need-based. So merit aid generally is awarded to kids who they want to come. So in other words, if you have to beg, borrow, and scratch and claw your way into a certain college that offers merit aid, you're probably not going to receive it. But if you're, in contrast, on the top 10% of or 20% of the kids who are applying, then you will be offered merit aid. And the average tuition discount increases every year, and last year it was 56.2%, according to the National Association of Collegiate Business Officers. So there's a lot of discounting going on, and paying full price is not an obligation. It's a choice. Now, some schools don't offer merit. That's the tiny fraction of elite Ivy and Ivy caliber schools. But out of the 4,000 colleges in the country, I think there's about 50 that admit 50% or less, or maybe it's 75 or 80. But the vast majority need you to come. And their business model is to say, this is our price, but we're going to discount you. And the cool thing, at least from my perspective, is that frequently that's negotiable. So one of my favorite things to do, and this is sort of the time of year traditionally when this happens, is to pit schools against each other and say, listen, you're my top choice school, but we got a better offer here. Can you possibly match? And if you do, then we're coming. So the key to that is, the best defense is a good offense. The key to that is having, when you finalize your college list, having some schools that compete with each other. And that can either be, colleges that are in the same athletic conference, or it could really be more about like schools that are sort of, similar to each other, going after the same types of kids. So one story I tell a lot is about a client of mine. This is going back to like 2012. But I run into him all the time. His name is Rick, and we're actually going to be going to the Barefoot Peddler tomorrow to watch basketball games. So he's like, you're going to tell my story again? I'm like, yeah. He goes, are you going to get it right this time? I'm like, shut up. Because I helped him basically get an extra $30,000 on top of what he was offered. That's the spoiler alert there. But you'd think he'd pick up the tab once in a while. He actually used to own the Wings Plus in Port Washington. You guys know that place at all? And I would get like a coupon for $5 off. I'm like, Rick, $30,000. Come on. Anyway, so in his case, his daughter, when she was finalizing her list, her top school was Southern Cal, USC. And she was a communications major. Now she's out working. She's got a great job. I mean, this is like a long time ago. And I suggested, why don't we have some schools that compete, with USC? And one of them was GW, which most people wouldn't think that's a competitor school to USC. You might think more like UCLA or Berkeley or, schools out there. But they also had a strong communications program, as did Syracuse, which was already on her list. And then when she finally got the financial aid awards, the two offers from Syracuse and GW were higher than from USC, which, of course, Murphy's Law, that was her top choice school. That's the way it usually works in college acceptances. So I said, okay, well, let's show those offers to USC. And I was kind of suspicious that the reason that they didn't give as high of an offer was because they're out in California. They didn't really understand. It's usually one of two things. They didn't understand the value of his house. They thought it was higher than we were arguing, because those are schools that care about your house. Private schools generally care about the value of your house. Not always, but generally that's the way it works. And he had just sold a different business, so his income was skewed. It looked like artificially high, but you don't sell a business every year, so it wasn't like an ongoing thing. So anyway, so we I wrote the appeal up, told him what to do with it, and then he sent it in, didn't hear back. Another couple of days go by, didn't hear back. He's starting to freak out. He's like, Alexa, my daughter, she's crying in the room. You got to help me out. I'm like, Rick, I don't have any feelings. Like, shut up. No, I said. So I went through the checklist again, and then as we were getting closer and we actually passed the housing deadline, which is nail biting, I said, okay, so did you this? Yes. Did you do that? Yes. Did you send a copy, not just to financial aid, but also to the admissions officer? And he's like, no, I forgot. I remember you told me to do that. I'm going to do that right now. And then the way he told me what happened next was he got a call either that day or the next day from the admissions officer. And she said, I didn't know this was going on at all. Who are you dealing with in the financial aid office? And he said, I don't know, some guy. And she's like, no, that's the wrong person. I'm going to go put this on the right person's desk. Her name is Mrs. blah, 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 and I'm going to have her call you. So that actually happened. He got a call it turned out to be the value of his house, not so much the business stuff. And they ended up increasing the award by $30,058. It's never a round number in financial aid for really no reason. So, and I think he got that every year, pretty much. You have to reapply every year, but you know, they honored it every year. So it was a big windfall. But the point is that number one, just because you get a crappy offer doesn't mean you know you're it's over, right? And number two, it helps to have that to have other offers for sure. And number three, most of the time you should be appealing to not only financial aid but also to admissions, because they're the ones who have a little more skin in the game. They're trying to get people to come. But in terms of the process, you know, most of the time, it's not required to get merit aid to fill out the financial aid applications, but we still, you know, still believe everyone should fill out a financial aid application. I mean, this is in the category of you're not going to hear this from your guidance counselor. So we just did financial aid applications earlier this week for a family that makes $7 million in adjusted gross income. And the reason we did it has to do with early decision. So are you guys familiar with what early decision is? Do you know the difference between early decision and early action? I'm not trying to quiz you, but yes or no? Want me to explain it?
Yes.
Not really, good.
Okay. You're still awake?
Okay.
All right, good. All right. right? Try the audiobook. early action is quote-unquote not binding, meaning the whole point of early action is that what it was supposed to do is take the stress out of the process. So the theory was if you get your applications in by November, you'll hear by December, and then you'll have a lot less waiting to do. But the reality was that because colleges were test optional, they got inundated with all these applications. So all the early ones, they're like, wow, we can't even read these, so we're just deferring everyone, which makes it more stressful. It's so stupid. So they couldn't figure out that was going to happen, even though it happens literally every year. So early decision is the way most people and most guidance counselors think of it, whether you're at a private or a public school, as binding, right? But here's why I challenge that. Number one, if you actually look at the early decision agreement, it says, basically, you know, if you apply early decision and we let you in, you have to come and rescind all of your other applications, unless the financial aid offer is not adequate for you to come. And there is no objective standard of adequacy. You guys, if you do this, you're sole judge and jury about what's adequate or not. So, I mean, the second reason is. Exactly. Yeah. Which guidance counselors don't—they're not going to tell you about that because what they're afraid of is that you'll taint next year's kids who apply to that school. And I'm like, yeah, exactly. I'm like that. I'm like, you know, your duty of loyalty is to yourself and your family, not them. So, and plus admissions officers don't really care about that. I mean, they don't have like a vendetta against you if you do that. I mean, I don't know, over the years I've probably had at least 12 to 15 kids use that financial out. And each time it's like they call up the admissions office and they're like, yeah, okay. Yeah, it's really not a big deal. But you know, if you think about it, your 17-year-old kid can't sign a contract. They lack the age of majority and they're kids. And if you really think about it, like who's gonna force you to go to a college and pay a certain price? I mean, we're not, you know, the country's a little messed up right now, but it's not that messed up, right? So the reason that our client with that high income just filed was because she got in early decision to Holy Cross, but she's still waiting to hear back from Notre Dame. So she's like, you know, we're kind of pushing the envelope a little bit, but if she somehow gets into Notre Dame, she wants to be able to tell Holy Cross, you know what, we can't afford, even though you know, we make $7 million, and I think he had like $7 million in cash in the bank or something. You didn't give us enough money, right? So that's on the up and up. You know, it's a little envelope pushy, but that's you know, it's fine. Yeah, it's two early decisions, right? Yeah, I'm giving you the simplified version too, right? So we in the biz call it ED2. Thank you very much. So so there's different ways to apply to college, right? There's the normal regular way, which has a deadline usually at the end of the year. And there's early action, which are generally accelerated, anywhere from October to November, maybe December. Depends on the school. And then there's early decision one, which is usually November 1 or November 15th. But you have to look up the deadlines for each school. They vary. There's no universal time to apply for admission or apply for financial aid. It all varies. You have to look. You have to stay on top of a lot of deadlines. And then what a lot of colleges started doing, mainly to grab the kids who didn't get in to their top choice early decision one schools, when they found out in December, you know, anywhere from the 1st to the 15th, was to come up with, oh, well, if you, and Tulane was probably one of the first schools to do this, I think. They said, oh, well, if you change your application from early action, because it's already been submitted, to this new thing that we created called early decision two, which is binding, if we accept you, then you're going to really improve your chances of getting in and getting money. So the early decision two was created with later deadlines, basically to calm the, or to stoke the neuroses of all the kids and parents and moms who didn't get good results in December. So most of those deadlines are like are right after the new year, up to January 15th. Yeah, I use so many terms I just fly out of my mouth. So if I'm doing that, I can't help it. I'm a recovering attorney. I like acronyms.
Yeah. And then early decision two.
Yeah, most of the high achieving kids that I work with are definitely they definitely avail themselves of early decision one. The conversation I have a lot is, okay, where should I use my early decision chit? You know, my ticket. Should I use it? You know, I've always wanted to go to Harvard, but I've got a 0.0002% chance of getting in. Should I use it there? Is that a waste? Or should I use it at, you know, Boston College or something like that? You know, I didn't talk so... Oh, yeah, I got more stuff to say about the 40%. Remember how I was talking before about 60% is academic and 40% is not academic? The thing I left out, and this was... this came to light more publicly during that affirmative action lawsuit against Harvard and against... University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, that was brought by an Asian American student who didn't get in with, you know, superior academics, and he's trying to, you know, argue that he was discriminated against, and the Supreme Court agreed, right? What came out is the types of categories of families and applicants that got preference. So, to rephrase that, at most competitive schools, they will reserve approximately 60 to 80% of their class for non-academic reasons. And they're called tags or selects or something. They get tagged or they get chosen. So those categories included underrepresented minorities, but still include recruited athletes, still for the most part includes legacies, you know, people whose parents went to those schools. International students, people apply early decision, get a little extra consideration. Low-income families get extra consideration. So if you're looking at the stats of a college and you're trying to gauge your odds of getting in, who here, you probably have. Has anyone else used Naviance in high school? It's probably too early. Have you used Naviance in first grade or third grade? Yeah, I know. That's just me amusing myself. There's no way. So Naviance is a sort of a software that most high schools use that's designed to kind of help you figure out. It's flawed, so I'm not going to get into it, but to handicap your odds of getting in to certain colleges. Look at your grades, look at your scores, and other kids from your high school who you know got accepted or didn't get accepted. And then you look at this clump. It's called a scattergram, and you're like, oh, okay, I have a good shot. One of the big flaws is that you're not competing with only your high school. You're competing with the kids all over the country and even the world. And the second one is that there's so many factors beyond grades and scores that get, you know, which is what I'm talking about, that get into the mix. So if you're a recruited athlete and you have, you know, kind of lower, you know, crappier grades and scores, but if you're recruited, you're probably going to get in most schools. Maybe not every school. You know, maybe not MIT because you have to be able to get in on your own, you know, and be great at a sport. But for the most part, That's how it works. So my point is, if you're looking at whatever you're looking at and you think, okay, you know, we're right in the middle, decent shot, and you're not one of those special categories, then your odds aren't as good as you think they are, because all those special categories, politically incorrect alert, all the special categories drag down the averages. So all those categories, another category is children of professors. They get special consideration too. So the legacies, the underrepresented minorities, the international students, the recruited athletes, they tend to drag down the averages. They score worse on the SAT and the ACT, and they have lower grades. So your real odds of admission, if you're not a special category, are definitely lower than whatever's being published. So my debate is always, you know, do you want to flush your early decision ticket down the toilet? And I don't always come down that way, because sometimes the kid's like, listen, I've worked this hard. I know I'm less than 50-50 to get in, but I don't want to have any regrets. And that's a big why. I think that's a big reason why a lot of people come to us or people like us. It's like, I just, you know, I've worked so hard. I've driven my kids all over town, all over the country for all the extracurriculars. I've gotten all these tutoring lessons. I've sent them to the camp, and you know, I don't want to drop the ball now. And I think kids also, you know, kind of feel that way. I'm so close. This is when I need the help the most. So I'm going early decision. So that could be right for them too. But it's, yeah, I've had that own discussion with my own kids too. It's like, I don't know if you want to use it at Yale when you can, you know, you're have a much better shot at Cornell. So that was how it went with my youngest daughter. All right. Anything else?
Safety schools.
Yeah, safety schools. Are there any?
I sort of, right. I've heard that, like, if you have a top student and they sort of, you know, don't get into the Ivies, but they try to get into, you know, sort of lower schools, mm-hmm. those lower schools sometimes don't accept them because they...
Yeah.
Okay,
so that is another great question that I never cover, and I'm glad you brought that up. What's the deal with safety schools and top students? So the broader concept here is that there's a percentage in college admissions that they are obsessed with, a stat called the yield. And the yield is the ratio of admitted to matriculated. So how many kids they admit and how many say, okay, I'm coming. And the worst at it, like at a top school, it's over 50%. At a normal school, it might be in the 20s or less. So if a school has a lower yield, it's not just an academic thing, it affects them, I won't get into it, but it affects them financially, it affects their rankings, you know, those types of things. So your question addresses the issue of colleges protecting their yields because they don't want to waste an admissions spot on someone that they know is not going to come, who's not interested in actually attending that school. So what you have to do, and I'm so glad you asked me this because this is a big thing too, what you have to do to attempt to overcome that assumption that makes sense is something called demonstrating interest. So demonstrating interest basically means sucking up like Eddie Haskell and Leave It to Beaver, which I don't know if anyone gets that. But colleges are, you know, let's just stipulate here, there's no privacy in America anymore, right, or anywhere else. So colleges track everything you do, which means that they're watching your behavior and feeding into their algorithm and their artificial intelligence, and they're making predictions on a lot of things, including whether you're likely to come at all, whether if they offer you a certain amount of merit scholarship money, you'll come, how much does it take, you know, how much is too low, etc. So the more you can beef up your interest score, which I'll tell you how to do, the greater your chances are of getting into a college, particularly if it knows it's being used as a safety school. So one of the things is visiting colleges, but nobody can visit every college, but that's an easy one. Another one is participating in many of the online sessions that they run. Another one is following them on social media. Another one is when you get an email, when your child gets an email, actually opening it. And even beyond that, going to, you know, where they send you on that landing page, and they will also check what you do from there. So what I'm getting at specifically is if your child says they're an engineering major, but they go and they spent all this time in the philosophy area, for example, and this is a real story. I mean, I'm sort of simplifying it. That might, you know, be a little bit of a red flag. So my point is that they're watching everything you do. So if you know that, then you can beat them at their own game and use this to your advantage. But sometimes, particularly the smaller schools, not necessarily, you know, the Michigans and Wisconsins and Penn States and those types of places, but sometimes with the smaller schools, it kind of comes down to each admissions office will work with outsourced consultants called enrollment management consultants, and they'll send, okay, here are all the lists of people that we're thinking about admitting, who should we admit? And they get fed into, you know, their algorithms, and they come back and say, not this one because blah, 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 this one, but you have to offer, you know, $30,000, you know, this one. So, yeah, it's really the world of big data. It's like Moneyball comes to college admissions. It's also creepy, but now you know. Who's a lot more cynical now than before they came in? 1, 2, 3, 4, okay. Yeah.
What about social media accounts, like for students applying?
Right.
Particularly if they're going to athletics.
Yeah.
I see some students now, like in middle school even, that are have accounts where they're posting images and pictures and videos of their games, et cetera. Is that a real thing that gets looked at?
So the question is about social media and athletes, but I'll expand that to like any students. I think every year when the polls come out and all the dumb trade publications that I read, when they emerge, they will usually say that more and more admissions officers admit that they're looking kids up on social. But I don't know how much time they can really spend doing this, because the average admissions officer will review 1,000 applications a year. I mean, I've got one guy who's a former admissions officer who used to read 2,500 a year. They don't have time. They spend about 5 or 6 minutes or 7 minutes on each application, and that's essays, transcripts, recommendations, you know, 5 or 6 other things. But on one hand, and this, I don't think this is as much of a case as it used to be, because you know, people have, you know, the Finsta instead of the Instagram, so where all the embarrassing stuff goes. But it used to be like, you know, kids were caught, not admitted, athletes in particular, where were being recruited, and then the coach found out from one of the assistant coaches that the kid before, you know, coming down for the athletic recruiting trip said something, oh, I can't wait to get all banged up at Maryland, you know, and the coach was like, hey, you know, and they met, like, you know, tell me, Sally, do you have a drinking problem? Right? So there's stories like that circulate. As long as you don't do anything stupid, I think that's fine on social media. But I think it's also kind of weird if you have no social media presence. That could be sort of a, you know, inverse red flag. One area where I think it could also be used as a, you know, to your advantage is, I had a client a few years ago. She's probably married with kids at this point. It's all a big blur to me. Who lives in Roslyn, and she decided to be to major in business, and she had a whole bunch of good stuff on her resume, you know, which we had talked about strategically. But I said, you know what? You don't have a LinkedIn profile. That's like a no-brainer. You know, you should put that together and then put that on your resume and send that to all your schools. And she actually ended up getting in to Northeastern. She went to Wheatley High School, and a lot of the kids that didn't get in had lower grades, had higher grades and scores than she did. So I'm not saying like that was the one thing that got her in, you know, because people always try. We always try to find like the one thing. It's never just one thing. But that was a standout thing in my mind that was different than probably the other kids that she was competing with, who weren't all business majors necessarily. But that was a way that we use social media to her advantage. So think about it like that. But yeah, in terms of recruiting stuff, we probably have, I don't know, 6 to 12 student athletes every year. I played basketball at college. Well, play is a little exaggeration, but I had great seats for the basketball games at Wesleyan University. And I went through the whole process. And I think what happens now is there's all these, like, you know, NCSA and all these other entities that will house your videos. But what it comes down to it is the way, if you have a student athlete, you should, in my opinion, you should be thinking about it as you're doing the recruiting, not being recruited. So you've got to proactively reach out to coaches and sort of introduce yourself. And, you know, what they care about is usually a little bit different than what kids think they care about and parents think they care about. So I have a really good client of mine who's a good friend at this point who lives out in San Diego. And she puts together products. You know, she's not a marketing person, but she's like a product person. And she did she was contacted by the family of John Wooden, who is one of the greatest college basketball coaches of all time, UCLA, coached Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and back before he changed his name, and he's legendary. And she put together a product that for his family that was all his sort of teachings kind of distilled, you know, his system kind of distilled into a product. And she was telling me that when she got to interview and read the transcripts of the 100 and something coaches that she contacted and interviewed for this project to try to distill the top, I think, 20 things that coaches look for in recruiting, the athletic stuff wasn't even in the top 10. It wasn't so much, you know, the skill stuff. It's more about your character, how you are as a teammate, you know, how do you respond to adversity, a lot of stuff like that. That was more about, you know, are you going to be a good teammate and coachable, as opposed to the skill stuff, which they sort of and athleticism is higher than skill, because you can teach skill, you can't really teach athleticism. But even higher than that was, you know, probably 8 to 12 non-athletic factors. So that was pretty interesting too. So when you're reaching out to coaches, that's the type of stuff that they're going to be looking at sooner or later. They care way more about grades and scores than people realize, and they care way more about character than people realize. It's not just like you're great on your club team. You've got to be, you know, a good teammate also. They also, and I'm not casting aspersions at all, but they also recruit the parents. So if I had she's still in college now. She's playing soccer. She's playing two sports actually at a Division III school. But there was one school that was recruiting her until the way the mom describes it, the mom and the dad are divorced. So they were recruiting this one athlete until they were at a game where they observed the dad screaming at the coach for not playing his daughter enough. And this college, yeah, I mean, it's funny, but it's like totally true. And this college coach is like, oh, next, you know. Yeah, I don't want to deal with this for 4 years, right? Right. So there's a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with sports that goes into this. Okay. All right, so I'm gonna wrap up here. So if you guys, I hope you found this valuable. My contact information is in those books. If you want to reach out and you want to talk about, you know, what, potentially getting our help, I'll waive the fee. There's no fee. And my office, it'll probably be on the phone, but my office is in Glenhead. It's actually in Glenwood Landing, but we're moving it to Glenhead, to the high rent district.
Can I ask one last question on financial aid?
Yeah, one and two.
You mentioned 56% discounted for the most part.
56.2, but let's not split hairs.
Right. Does that include merit aid, grants, scholarships?
Yeah, it's all.
Okay, everything.
Yeah, yeah. The average discount, whether it's merit or need, is off tuition, not room and board, is half off, more than half off.
Thank you. What age do you recommend people engage
in? Yeah. Did I already use my in utero joke?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, all right. I'm great with diapers too.
That was your best joke of the night.
Huh, really? Well, you missed that one. Yeah, good thing I repeated it. Yeah, I've been saying the same jokes for like easily 10 years. The short answer is, look, the earlier you start, the better. And the earlier, you know, again, that whole body of work starts in ninth grade. But, you know, a lot of kids aren't ready. They're not coachable. And so I turn down, maybe half a dozen kids a year who the parents drag in. And I'm like, okay, obviously they don't want to be here, right? So, you know, so it kind of, it really depends on when the family is ready and whether the kid is ready. But in general, you know, the earlier you start, the better.
Ninth grade.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people in general, it's like end of 10th, beginning of 11th. But the ones, you know, I have a lot of kids who start with us in 8th and 9th because they have older kids who went through the process and didn't really work out that well for them, or did work out because they worked with us. And then, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
But starting
early,
I mean, do you help with strategizing from, to build the narrative, from that moment, yes, take those classes, yes, do that summer program, or, recommending those, that type of guidance, that's what I feel like we're missing.
Yeah.
It's like, we know what you're saying, and we hear that, but implementing that,
It's two different things. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I'm not a cheerleader, I'm a coach, so implementation is very big with me. But understanding the overall strategy and also figuring out how you're wired, what that could translate into in terms of majors and careers where you could actually love what you do and not major in something stupid that's not going to help you get a job. Again, not to be too politically incorrect, but when was the last time anyone ever heard of a CEO saying, "Get me the gender studies kid," right? I mean, you can't, there's so many ways to blow $300,000 worth of college tuition and room and board to get your kid a job at Chipotle. So that's a big thing with me is the return on investment, the college return on investment. So we start with kids kind of right away in learning how to think about objectively, not based on anecdote, but based on data, places in the world where they can love what they do so work doesn't feel like work, and they can make a living. And that can happen, as early, because they don't know the right questions to ask, but we do. So that starts whenever, and then the rest of it is, okay, well, now let's draw out a roadmap to get, to have a plan A, B, C, D, whatever, and that kind of evolves like a big funnel, just kind of getting narrower and narrower. But again, what it comes down to for me is whether the kid's willing to do it. And so I have some kids who are incredibly motivated, and like I said before, I have some kids who are just a waste of time and they shouldn't be dragged in by their, by their hair. Yeah, but I think earlier is better. Okay?
Thank you.
All right, yeah, good. All right, thanks guys. All right,
appreciate
it. Enjoy the sleep aid.
Thanks again.
All right, you got it. Thanks for coming. I mean, it's nice, you guys know more, I think, than 99% of your peers. So, so you get a gold star. All right.
The financial aid, is that if you get it the first year, will you get it every year if it's a merit aid?